You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, Selena Green here for The Country Hour on this Monday. Great to have your company. In just a moment, you're going to hear details about what is proposed to be Australia's second largest olive grove, and it's going to be planted right here in South Australia. When it's up and running, I'm told it'll be producing millions of litres of olive oil on site. So, more details about who's planting it, why they're planting it there, and where is that olive oil going to go? Also today, what's the oldest piece of farm machinery that you have at your place? You might be hard-pressed to beat one farmer in the state's north who's been rolling out a 95-year-old header and putting it to work.
I remember Dad telling me they got it stuck in a foxhole when they had steel wheels on it, and then after they got it stuck, they pulled it out and they got a local engineering mob at Yorktown put rubber tyres on it.
That's coming up later on in the program. But first today, yes, a massive olive grove and olive oil processing facility is being proposed for Wakery in the Riverland, and its developers say it could be up and running by 2028. Leipzig, Australia is behind the proposal, which involves 385,000 olive trees planted across 1,000 hectares and a facility producing an average of 2.5 million litres of olive oil a year. When it's finished, it's expected to be the second biggest olive grove in Australia and the biggest in South Australia. Of course, a project this big throws up questions around jobs, market demand and, of course, water. I spoke with Leipzig's chief executive, Frank Vanassis, to find out more about what they want to build.
We're proposing South Australia's largest olive grove initially, which will be planted in two 500 hectare plantations. We're also proposing a small employment agricultural park to facilitate the large scale agricultural processing for the olive oil.
So initially olive groves being planted, and what when they're mature and ready to be processed, you'll be processing them into olive oil on site. Is that sort of the ultimate end goal there?
Yeah, it is spot on. So it's going to take a few years for the olive trees to come to maturity. Once they are at maturity and we start picking the fruit, we have a goal to process that oil from the fruit within 4 to 6 hours. So we want the processing facility on site. And to facilitate such a large quantum of fruit, the building's quite big. And part of that process is to look at rezoning some land to facilitate large-scale processing of agricultural products, in this case, the olive fruit.
How many trees are you looking to plant all up on those, 2,500-hectare blocks, I think you mentioned there?
Yeah, we've currently propagated 385,000 trees, and they will be planted in two tranches. So around 385,000 trees will go in the ground, give or take, you know, depending on some of the paddock sizes. But the soil profiling we've done and the EM38 survey conducted indicates 1,000 hectares of land is really suitable with the right soil profile to meet the standard of what we're trying to deliver. There is around 1,750 hectares on that land. The residual land will be the feedlot and the employment area for the processing of the fruit and other industry.
Why Wakery? Why that location was the one you chose?
It comes down to feasibility. So when we looked at doing a project of this size, the scale, it needs to be feasible. There's a lot of money that's being invested. There's a strategic rail corridor that runs along McGee Road down to the riverbank. That rail corridor came part of the land sale. So we are able to utilise that rail corridor through Crown Lands to put infrastructure in to facilitate development, in this case the olive grove. It's difficult to find a block of land that big close to the river, so it's the balance between infrastructure cost and land cost. There's a lot of sun, really nice weather, it's dry, it's perfect for olives. So we don't necessarily need rain for olives. What we need is irrigated facilities, water, and we need sun and sunny weather, which we've got, and the soil profile. Wakery, this particular site, ticked all those boxes, and we went ahead and secured it in 2023 with the settlement occurring in early 25. And we have another site very close by, which we call Site 2. Both sites have been in the same family for 99 years, so probably an emotional transition for the family, and a great opportunity for us to utilise that land in what we think is going to be, an opportunistic and a lot of potential for the current region.
You mentioned water there. Will all these trees be fully irrigated? Is the plan to irrigate these orchards?
Yeah, absolutely. So each tree will receive between 60 and 90 litres of water a day through a 900 mil pipeline that's getting constructed from the riverbank all the way through to the middle of the property. So the property's 10 kilometres from the riverbank and the dam's around 3 kilometres from the edge of the property. So 900 mil pipe, 13.25 kilometres, pumps around 900 litres of water a second, which will fill the dam up. And the dam will have around 14 days of residual capacity in the event that we have power failure or something were to occur where the pumping couldn't continue. It's integral those trees receive the same amount of water through, the technology that we've got to identify how much moisture content is in the soil. And we will keep that moisture content optimum with fertilizer in order to keep that tree growing. So this is a proven technique. It's a formula that we're following. Well, our managers are following.
Is there a reason you've gone down that path of irrigate? Because obviously there are both sides. There are olive groves that are irrigated and non-irrigated here in Australia, a lot that aren't irrigated. What's the reasoning behind going down the path of irrigation?
Yeah, so our olive grove has been supported by two substantial businesses. One is an ASX-listed company and the other one is a local processor who's been three generations in the industry. We're following a proven technique that they currently utilise, and our oil has been pre-purchased for 30 years, subject to us following certain conditions. One of these conditions are, obviously irrigating the trees and following a very strict control and audited process to make sure we maximise the utility of each tree, and we look after those trees because they are, in essence, the heartbeat of the project. So it's a formula that's proven, and we are going to be adopting that formula, which is audited, and we follow that process through. So we're not farmers, we're developers, and we have employed the services of a management company that has the know-how, I suppose, to get the most out of the trees.
So have you secured that water? Is that coming from entitlements?
Yeah, so the water, we've had the site use approval granted from Minister Susan Close to use the water, and the water can be obtained through multiple different channels. It can be pre-purchased, the entitlement can be purchased, it can be leased, and then it can be the on-the-spot market as well. So we've progressed that conversation with a substantial company, and we're pretty close to finalising our water rights for the future.
You're listening to the South Australian Country Hour. Selena Green with you today, and I'm speaking with Frank Vunasits from Leipzig, Australia. Now, they're behind a proposed olive grove and olive oil processing facility for near Wakery, and when up and running, the project proposes 385,000 olive trees, and it will, when operating, be one of the nation's largest and certainly South Australia's largest grove. How much olive oil do you expect to be generating at full production?
Yeah, for the first 1,000 hectares of oil will aggregate to around 2.5 million litres on a good year and a bad year, but 2.2 on a bad, 2.8 million litres on a good year. So around 2.5 million litres year on year out on average.
I think you mentioned there before there was a pre-purchase, or you do already have a market for a lot of that olive oil?
Yeah, look, we are really proud to say that every drop of oil has been pre-sold for the next 30 years. It's sold to an ASX-listed company. It'll be grown for one customer, and that customer services most of Australia and parts of probably about seven, eight countries really around the world. But most of the oil will be used locally, and it creates local jobs. So, yeah, all has been pre-purchased.
So obviously, there's a market for it, and I guess that's one of the questions that I haven't asked yet is why olives? Obviously, there are lots of growers in the region, maybe from grapes, looking to diversify into olives. We know it's a growing industry, so the decision to go into olives, that was an easy one?
Yeah, probably not easy. Our projects have diversified significantly, and what I found is the amount of time you spend on a smaller project in a more metro part of South Australia, for example, we do a lot of development in Anglevale, Virginia. What we found is the infrastructure challenges, the competition of other developers, trying to acquire a large enough site to make things feasible, that's becoming really challenging. So we started to diversify into employment land. And then when we went into employment land, we found that employment land was less competitive, but also harder to find the right land. When you pair residential employment land and industry together, and you start getting obviously a pipeline of work already in place, it's easier to invest. So when we looked at doing a farming project or an agricultural project, it wasn't necessarily going to be olives. What we identified was bringing water to a site and activating a site for an agriculture activity. There was a few different options for that land. We landed on olives and we landed on olive oil at the end of the process where we audited what all the opportunity was going to be. Now, the scale of this project allows us to be competitive and allows us to pre-sell it all for 30 years. One thing that we have learned along this process is large agricultural projects aren't for everyone. It's patient capital. You have to be patient. You have to wait. A lot of the smaller groves, by the time they plant 50 or 100 hectares, by the time they get irrigation water there, they've spent some money. They've got to wait 5 years sometimes to get a return. That's not ideal for everyone. So you've got to look at which model works for you and which model doesn't. In this case for us, it worked for us because the partners on board with the project, being the management company and the offtake company, they are well and truly patient. And we are also in that profile of our investment maturity where we were able to be patient and wait to see the reward. It's not going to come tomorrow, but it will come in the future. That's an important part of this and the scale. So we'd love to see more oil. And I'll finish answering that question with 60% of Australia's olive oil is still imported from overseas. So there is a local opportunity to have good quality olive oil. It doesn't mean we all can get in there and start planting olive trees and it's going to work. There's a scale to the feasibility of it. And in this case, we feel that we've nailed the scale right.
Leipzig's chief executive, Frank Vanassis. The company says it already has major approvals granted and infrastructure will start being built this year. It aims to have the trees planted by autumn 2027, the aim of having processing underway on site in 2028-29. It's also working with the local council and state government on addressing housing for the jobs that will be attached to the project. As to the question of why olives, we'll stick around because later on in the program, you'll hear from the Australian Olive Association about the changes the industry has undergone that's led to it being on the cusp of a boom here in Australia.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Next, it may not always feel like it, but harvest is a lot easier than it was a century ago. And that's something that Lee Baker, who farms at Wild Horse Plains, about 75 kilometres north of Adelaide, knows all too well. Lee's an avid collector of old machinery, and this harvest, he put a 95-year-old Sunshine auto header to work. His grandfather bought the machine back in 1950, before Lee bought it from him in the late 70s. Though he does not know how often it was used, he heard stories about it from his father.
I remember Dad telling me they got it stuck in a foxhole when they had steel wheels on it, and then after they got it stuck, they pulled it out and they got a local engineering mob at Yorktown, put rubber tyres on it.
And so why did you want to buy it?
I just like old things, and I thought that's the only sentimental thing that I was going to get from the family.
And what kind of quality was it in when you got it?
Didn't go, I towed it home, and then I brought it back here and put it in our shed, and then I drug it out about approximately 30 40 years later. When I had a triple bypass, I lost all motive in life, and I thought, well, I'd do something. I got that out, freed it all up, the knife was seized, probably had a wheelbarrow load of rat manure in the thrasher was seized, there was sheepskin parts all through it, and then I bought a new set of plugs and got my cousin to make a new exhaust, and we towed it probably 10 metres and it started, and it starts reasonably good now. And we bought a new header this year, my son did, so I just wanted to put a comparison between the new one and the old one to say that the old still can do the job.
So you took it out a couple of weeks ago. Was that the first time you've had it out working?
Well, I had it out 4 years ago, but only did a little bit that time just to get it going. Then we put it in the shed, and then, I thought I'd get it out this year. And all I wanted was a photo next to the new ones, next to the old one, so I can put it on the wall.
And how did it run out in the paddock?
It ran quite well, actually. Well, it ran out of petrol once, because I only had the little tank full of petrol. I didn't, because it runs on kerosene. I haven't got kerosene, so filled the little tank of petrol up. We went, and then it ran out, so I put some more in it, and then we got it going again and did a bit more. It did get fairly hot. I suppose it was a warm day, but I suppose we're not used to sitting so close to the motor. We're all, nowadays, we're just used to sitting in air-conditioned cab and luxury. And GPS, whereas this takes a little bit to steer it and to work out how to use the header. Like, you need to start probably 10 metres before you actually get to the crop. You need to put, because it's only got one clutch, so you need to put the header in gear and the drive gear in gear at the same time. So you need to hit the crop at full speed with the header going. So that took a little bit to get used to how to work that one out.
What else is different from this compared to the new stuff?
I suppose the air-conditioned cab and auto steer, I suppose. I couldn't get the young ones to drive it.
What's the process?
It holds approximately 3 to 4 bags, the little box, and then you have somebody on the side which bags it off, and then I think it holds 10 or 11 bags on the bagging platform. Then when you fill that, you go over and you put all the bags together and someone sews the bags up.
How many did you get when you took it out?
Oh, we only did 2 or 3 bags.
How long did that take?
Probably, I don't know, we're out there mucking around for an hour by the time we got it worked out how to work it. I want to get it out in 5 years' time when it's 100 years old. I'm going to play with it a bit more and get the rust out of it more, and now that I'm starting to get used to how to work it. It has got an instruction book, but I should have read that first, I suppose.
I think it's pretty normal for a farmer not to read an instruction book, from what I know.
I think you're right there. I don't think you'd get parts for it anymore, unless you find an old one that's wrecked to get the parts off it.
And in terms of the front, how does it cut compared to the new stuff?
Well, this is like a comb front, the old style. And the new ones are all open front, so they don't block up as much. The open front, the new ones, whereas these seem to block up if you've got turnip or rubbish in your crop as well. You'll have more trouble with these feeding than what the new ones. But I suppose when you look at it, they're basically the same principle. It cuts it off, goes up into the thrasher and thrash it, and then it goes through over the walkers. Whereas this has got walkers, the new ones don't have walkers. I like playing with old stuff, and I just like mucking around with it. I've always liked old stuff.
Lee Baker there talking to Isabella Kelly about his vintage farm machinery. There is a fantastic video of this 1930s harvester at work next to some more much more modern ones. Just head online to abc.net.au/rural to find Isabella's great story.
80 years of the Country Hour, Australia's longest running radio show.
Hi, I'm Jackson from Lamoury. Happy 80th birthday to the Country Hour.
At this time, post-harvest and into the new year can give landholders a bit of a chance to catch up some jobs around the property that can boost your resilience and biodiversity. To give a bit of a hand, Landscape Hills and Fleurieu have released stewardship guides for landholders that really apply, well, to anyone right across the state. Senior Stewardship Officer Will Hannaford explains some of the seasonal jobs that people can do at this time of year to set themselves up.
Because it's summer, you hear the message from CFS often enough, and it's really important, and that is managing your vegetation for bushfire safety. And I guess one of their main themes is really doing something around your house and in a certain distance from your house, keeping grass low and keeping vegetation under control there. But there's also fire retardant native ground cover species like ruby saltbush that you can use, and that they provide great ground cover and an ornamental purpose, and there's other species that you can use there to do that job.
And I know the Adelaide Hills in particular has had some problem with pest species. Are there any in particular people should be on the lookout for over summer?
Yeah, we are really trying to encourage as many people as possible to download an app called Feral Scan. Some people might already have it on their phone, but it's a really useful bit of information that you can enter into your phone, and we get that information. And what we're trying to do is coordinate a regional control of feral animals, particularly goats and deer. So That's one of the main things people can do locally and right across the state. It's used, so that app is called Feral Scan, and it's really easy to use. So we're really trying to encourage people to help us out with that one.
Is anything coming through on that in particular that are concerning? Any pest species?
Yeah. I mean, we've been doing work on goats in the Adelaide Hills and Thurio for quite some time, and we've been getting reports through Feral Scan for a number of years, and it's really helped us to bring those numbers right down. We're now starting to concentrate on feral deer, and people are using the app and we're getting reports, and it's been really helpful.
You also have stewardship guides to help people. These have been developed with the Landscape Board. What do they entail?
Yeah, I guess for Landscapes Hills and Thurio, we've just recently developed these stewardship guides, and they're for people to use. They're really easy and handy to use. There's a number of them. There's weed control, there's revegetation, there's looking after native vegetation, there's a couple of dam guides, and there's also some soil resources as well. And I'm sure the other landscape boards have got some great information, but they're just really, really useful to download and either keep as an electronic copy or come in and grab a hard copy. And they're just fantastic guides if you want to specifically tackle a certain theme on your property dealing with your natural assets.
I know rabbits in particular have been a concern for not just the hills but other parts of South Australia as well. What sort of work are you seeing and do you want people to do over summer when it comes to rabbits?
Yeah, rabbits are in some areas like the Adelaide Hills in particular. They're a persistent pest. They've been around in large numbers really for the last 10 years. So we've been working on some resources and we're really trying to encourage people to try to use as many methods as possible to keep rabbits under control on their properties. A good one, a simple one is reducing harbour. It's a bit of an old-fashioned word, but that's just the habitat or the places that rabbits use as home. Often in areas like the Adelaide Hills, they actually don't have burrows, but they're just under sheds, under rubbish, under vegetation. So if you can just clean up your yards, I guess it's also good for your bushfire safety as well. Rabbit-proof fencing is really effective, particularly in the Adelaide Hills. We've got a lot of peri-urban properties with rabbits, and you know, looking up, protecting their gardens is just a foolproof method when you put up rabbit-proof fencing. But there's other methods of control, traditional methods. Maybe on larger properties, there's baiting, fumigation, and warren destruction as well. So please check out your landscape board websites for useful information about all that sort of stuff.
That's touching on the pest animals, but when it comes to a weed point of view, what else are you focusing on?
Many areas in South Australia have problems with woody weeds, and it's always better to try and, I guess with any weed, to try and get onto things earlier the better. In Adelaide Hills and Thurio, there's quite a bit of blackberry. Blackberry is a plant that actually expands in its extent by layering. So even if you get out there and do some brush cutting on those big long stems, you can actually keep that blackberry in the same extent it was before it put out those long stems. And of course, there's many other ways. You know, you can use chemical and herbicide, and there's lots of different types of selective herbicides for blackberry. So we really encourage people to phone us, speak to us. But we've got our new weed control guide in Hills and Thurio, and I'm sure there's other resources across the state where, you know, you can just go to the website and find out some really useful information.
And overall, it's been a tough year for a lot of people season-wise. You started the year in the Adelaide Hills in a very dry situation with people carting water. How is the region looking now heading into 2026?
Memories, you know, sometimes your memory is a bit short term. You know, 6 months ago, it was very different than it is now. We've actually had in the Adelaide Hills and Surrey Peninsula a pretty good spring. I actually can't remember. My memory's not that good, but we've had a pretty good spring, and it is still green. Often in, you know, previous years, things have dried out through November, but it is a later spring, and we've had fantastic native vegetation response in terms of lilies and orchids and things like that. We've had a pretty good amount of hay and silage cut, even though it was wet in November, and some people, you know, hay was delayed, and maybe there was quite a bit of hay on the ground. But, you know, it is looking pretty fresh out there, even though now, you know, we're getting some warmer wet weather and things are starting to dry off. So it's a bit of a chalk and cheese situation, particularly even last spring when it was quite dry.
And the Hills and Fleurieu Landscape Board has put quite a lot of effort into dams. You've also had a few concerns around dams. How are you going getting information and I guess, more security around dams?
Yeah, there's been a bit of a statewide push as well to talk about dams in terms of doing sort of regular dam health checks to make sure that they're in good condition and there's no problems. Dam maintenance is pretty important, and, you know, over summer it's a great time just to have a bit of a walk around your dam. Have a walk around the outside wall. Look for anything that looks different. Some dams do leak a little bit below the dam wall. If they've always done that, that's probably fine. But if you see anything new, that's a bit of a telltale warning sign that there may be something happening. You're looking for cracks or slumping, and you want to also check your spillway, that's the outflow area, and the inflow area for erosion. We also try to really encourage landholders to think about fencing off their dams. That's that dam enhancement piece. There's kind of two sides to it. There's the dam maintenance, then the dam enhancement. So if people can fence off their dams, that dam and the surrounding area can become a really important area for nature on your property. So fencing off the dam and getting a trough on the outside is a really good thing to improve the natural asset value of your property.
Landscape Hills and Fleurieu Senior Stewardship Officer Will Hannaford speaking to Cassie Huff.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now let's take a look at the weather for South Australia this week. We have a high pressure system centred south of SA, extending a ridge over the west of the state and a broad trough lingering over the far northeast. That high will move eastwards early this week and a broad trough will move across the west in the middle of the week. For tomorrow, South Australia is expecting a dry and mostly sunny day, hot to very hot with maximum temperatures well above average, southeast to northeasterly winds and afternoon sea breezes near the coast. Moving through some top temperatures across the state, Adelaide 31 tomorrow, Mount Barker 29 and Victor Harbour 23, Cleve 28, Whyalla 30 tomorrow, Oraru 35, Port Augusta expecting 34, 27 for Kingscote, 31 for Cummins and 25 for Port Lincoln. In the southeast, top temperatures expected of 26 for Mount Gambier, 31 in Narracourt and 32 for Keith and Bordertown. In the mid-north, Clare and Port Pirie 33, Jamestown 34. To the Murraylands, Murray Bridge expecting a top of 30, Caroondah and Lamoureux 33 and in the Riverland 35, the high expected for Renmark. In the northeast pastoral district, 39 forecasts for Lee Creek and Oodnadatta, 41 for Murray and Moomba. In the northwest, 37 forecasts for Coober Pedy, Marla, Tarcoola and Woomera, and 28 in Roxby Downs. To the west coast, 28 for Ceduna tomorrow, 36 for Woodna. And finally, to the York Peninsula, 31 in Cadena, Minleton and Maitland. And in Edithburg, 25 is the top forecast for tomorrow. Looking at the western inland parts of New South Wales for Tuesday, sunny in the upper western district, overnight temperatures between 20 and 26 degrees. During the day, around 40. Very similar forecast for the lower western district, sunny conditions, overnight temperatures between 17 and 21, during the day reaching around 40 degrees.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Selena Green with you for the South Australian Country Hour today. Hope you're having a great Monday. If you're listening on earlier on in the program, we heard from a company that's in the process of developing South Australia's largest olive grove, aiming to process up to 2.8 million litres of olive oil on site every year when it's up and running. And they say that they've pre-sold that oil for the next 30 years before a shovel even hits the dirt. Now, this comes as the wider olive industry could be on the cusp of a big expansion here in Australia. That's due to significant changes to quality controls on olive oil and production techniques for table olives. Paul Miller is a consultant and director of the Australian Olive Association. David Claughton met him at a business event for startups in Sydney recently and asked about developments in the olive sector.
For, I guess, 20 years, I've been spending time there working with the American olive oil producers who were facing the same problems that we were, with product on the shelf that wasn't extra virgin olive oil, labelled as extra virgin olive oil. You know, you can eat it and cook with it, but it didn't have the nutritive value and people didn't respond flavour-wise. So our work on standards here ultimately was adopted by California into law, which is really something, I think, you know.
We haven't done the same here?
Oh, of course not. No, Australia, we have a standard with Standards Australia. It's voluntary. And we ended up convincing the supermarkets and the major producers that this was important. And then they started to make better margins out of slightly higher priced extra virgin olive oil because it tasted good, acknowledging that that taste relates to the culinary value and nutrition, you know. So,
and the supermarkets were insisting on some kind of, not a certified product, but a product that had been properly tested,
Yeah, exactly. Aldi led the way, interestingly enough, because they were actually doing this in Germany. That's where I found the technology, in Germany in 2005. And I brought it back to Australia, and our chemists kind of adopted it and then ran with it and developed some ways of predicting shelf life and the life of extra virgin olive oil as extra virgin and so on. And that's
Love that story. Normally we do something but can't commercialise it and someone else takes it.
I'm with you. But I flew all the way to Germany for a 2.5 hour meeting, a presentation, because it looked interesting and we knew we had a problem here by 2005. And I met these German guys and they were like, oh, you know, the authorities will never adopt this and it works. And I said, look, if this works, we'll take it and we'll run with it. And they gave us the methods. And now we're working with them on a standard for the Food and Drug Administration in the US, which would be nationwide for all olive oil traded in the US. And I think we're reasonably confident that will happen. It might take a year or two, but I think it'll happen. And that's important. But what's more important is that some of the retailers and some of the major olive oil companies in the world, the biggest traders, have worked out that there actually is money in flavour, there is money in nutrition, and they've worked out that that's where we're coming from. And have adopted this technology themselves. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of proud that Australia, you know, we fell over it in Germany, we did something here, we got the Americans interested, we persisted, we wouldn't go away against huge resistance, and now it's improving things globally. In fact, I was in the US in May speaking with a company there that trades about 25% of the olive oil in the US, which is a huge amount, way more than Australia consumes. And the CEO there said to me, you know, Paul, if we can make sure that extra virgin olive oil really is extra virgin on the shelf, the sky is the limit for the industry. And I thought, that's awesome, because 20 years ago, those people didn't want to speak to me. Mm-hmm. You know, they were in the business of the cheapest possible product. But it's turned it around, and we had a little bit to do with it. Yeah. We didn't do it all by ourselves, of course, and the Americans got involved, and there's some great chemists and people over there. But it's been a big part of my life for the Australian Olive Association, I'm happy with that.
And the quality's obviously improved for consumers. So the consumers totally. Of Australia, thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure. I love extra virgin olive oil, I've got to tell you.
Now, what are you doing here?
Yeah, right, so a bloke in South Australia called John Felke, he's a professor at the University of South Australia, who's worked a lot in mechanisation of almonds and wheat and stuff like that. He's an engineer. He tried out some, once again, technology that he came across in the US, where you can debitter table olives, he found out, by taking the brine out of the tank and running it through a kind of a selective filter that takes some of the bitter compounds out. And also he's done some other things with it to do with oxygen levels and water flow. Clever stuff, you know. It's very gentle on the olives. They don't ferment. There's no water used. You don't have to discard the water, which is a big change, a really big change in processing olives. Anyway, someone mentioned me to him and he sent me some olives, I guess 5 years ago. And I'm not a big olive eater traditionally.
Olives are not always that good.
No, that's right. I mean, they're okay. It's kind of an acquired taste. But what I don't like about the traditional table olives is the aftertaste is not really good. You need to wash it down with something, you know. So I got these olives from him and I tasted them and my eyes lit up because they tasted like extra virgin olive oil. Well, not exactly the same, but they had those kind of fruity flavours and it was very clean and the aftertaste was beautiful. So I went back to him and said, I think you've got something here. And fortunately for me, the UniSA put me on a small retainer for a few months just to think about the strategy and so on. And then he got a bigger grant, what's called an AEA Innovate grant from the Education Department to scale this up and see whether it could be commercial. And that led to us being introduced through a guy called Thomas Ting, who used to work at UniSA, who's here today, introducing us to Beanstalk as a kind of an educational exercise about what commercialisation means with new tech, which has been great. I mean, it's been really interesting. We've been exposed to all sorts of things and challenged as to whether this is going to work and so on. And I think it will work, but what I am kind of excited about is that it's an Australian development. And once again, it's about things that taste good. And we're starting now to measure the makeup of these olives, phenolic compounds and nutritional compounds with the University of Adelaide. And it looks like they're pretty high in phenolics, which makes sense because the phenolics in extra virgin olive oil drive the flavour, right? And they're also really good for you. They're antioxidants and all sorts of impacts on human health. So we think we've got this in these olives. They taste pretty good. And Thomas is presenting today, and we're kind of at the point now where we're starting to talk to chefs and food culinary experts to see what they think.
Paul Miller there, a consultant and director of the Australian Olive Association, speaking with David Claughton. Now, speaking of industry expansion, and seaweed could soon be big business here in Australia. Researchers are pretty excited about its possible uses in everything from agriculture through to pharmaceuticals. Here in South Australia, researchers are looking into ways to help scale up the nation's seaweed farming industry, including the production of methane-reducing asparagopsis. The South Australian Research Development Institute, or SARDI as we better know it, they've been involved in the establishment of a national hatchery network, part of an $8 million federal program. To find out more, I spoke with the Aquatic Science Program Lead at SARDI, Associate Professor Shushi Nair.
This came about from DAF, Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, the Commonwealth Agency, who has been promoting seaweed aquaculture in Australia. And one of the biggest bottlenecks we've identified with developing a seaweed industry in Australia is the hatchery technology, or developing inoculum or seed stock for commercializing seaweed aquaculture in Australia. So what they did was they funded a national hatchery network with two nodes, one based out of James Cook University in Queensland and one based out of South Australian Research and Development Institute at West Beach. And the purpose of establishing the two nodes was one would be a temperate node focusing on the temperate seaweed or the cold water seaweeds, and the other one was a tropical node, which had a focus on tropical species that occurs in the warmer climate. So we were fortunate enough to be selected to host the temperate seaweed node at West Beach. And this was a collaborative project that involved also the Australian Sustainable Seaweed Alliance, who had researchers from that organization based here at West Beach who worked with our researchers and developed hatchery technology for Asparagopsis amata, which is a red seaweed that is a temperate seaweed, cold water species that when fed in ruminants, there is documented evidence in the literature that it can reduce methane emissions from anywhere from about 70% through to about 95%.
So that Asparagopsis, I understand, that's a native seaweed that is found sort of along this southern coast. Is the challenge then to take something that is naturally occurring in the environment and then recreate that in a commercial sense or in a way that it can be bred up as an industry on land?
That's correct. So the land-based, a few commercial operators currently in Australia that are commercializing the seaweed, which is Asparagopsis, basically working with the livestock industry. So we basically got involved in this project trying to develop robust, scientifically validated hatchery technology for rapid upscaling of inoculum production. So that is a seed stock that is needed. Then that can be then inoculated into larger land-based ponds, which can then be upscaled and the biomass can be produced. So that's where we came in. And we looked at several opportunities or technology that we developed as a part of this project. So things like looking at fragmentation versus CO2 carbon delivery into the hatchery system, or optimizing the light, the spectral quality of light. These were all the various factors we looked into. And as a result, we also looked at spore cultivation, not just the vegetative propagation. So these can be cultivated two ways, using vegetative techniques where you basically fragment or break up the tissue and they grow vegetatively, or you develop the spore-based cultivation, which is a bit more laborious process. But they are all part of that hatchery technology which we looked at, and effectively important in closing the life cycle of the seaweed on land, which we did.
Is this research completed, or is this still ongoing?
Yeah, so the funding for that program finished up in June. So we have been working on seaweeds for quite some time, not just focused on Asparagopsis, but also other fairly significant seaweeds, such as Eclonia radiata, which is a golden kelp for food applications, cosmetics, nutraceuticals, all of that. So there's a lot of other seaweeds that we're working on, including sea lettuce for human consumption. So we have an interest, and that work is continuing. We now have Australia-Indonesia grant, and we are trying to develop this some of these technology further to be able to progress this work and learn a bit more and commercialize the technology.
As you say, a lot of the research is around using this as a feedstock for methane reduction in livestock, but there are so many other applications, future applications that we're looking into for seaweed.
Absolutely. And we've been working on seaweed since 2008. And what we have now as a result of this funding, the previous DAF funding, as well as state government funding is and industry funding too, is to develop a multi-species seaweed hatchery here at West Beach, and which we have done. And there are lots of commercial opportunities that we have looked at, and some of them are very close to commercialization, such as looking at natural pigments from seaweed, color pigments, food color, various applications for enhancing the coloration in meat products through to plant-based burgers, or you're looking at food products, increasing the protein content in some of the seaweeds where it becomes substantial protein feedstock, or looking at things such as nutraceuticals or cosmeceuticals where you have skin UV protective creams, things like that. So there's a lot of spin-off opportunities, and seaweeds have application in from wine clarification through to pharmaceuticals, gelling agents, and they have been, in some parts of the world, they have been utilized for centuries. So it's very much ingrained in their culinary culture. In Australia, it's a relatively new industry in that sense because we have not had established seaweed industry or an established cultural practice utilizing seaweeds at scale. So we develop partnerships with industry that can take it to commercialization because that's the critical element to the success of this. So we are partnered with tuna farmers in Port Lincoln, where we are growing some of these seaweeds adjacent to tuna farms, where there is a significant benefit in assimilating nutrients that come out of the tuna farms or finfish farming in Port Lincoln, and that gets incorporated into the seaweed biomass that is then taken out. We have developed a seaweed biostimulant, which is a product that can enhance growth in plants, so they have plant growth regulators. So that's probably a commodity scale product where you're relying on natural biofouling species. But there's also targeted opportunities where we develop hatchery technology. For example, golden kelp is a good example of that, where we produce seeded lines that go to oceanic leases, where we basically develop long line systems and then we let it grow and we harvest on a periodic interval. And then that biomass that is harvested have a variety of uses from food, as I mentioned, from food to functional food to nutraceuticals, cosmeceuticals, bioactives, a lot of antioxidants and other applications. So there is a significant demand for seaweed-based products and a significant demand for seaweed biomass, and we are pretty much at the infancy in terms of producing the biomass.
That was Associate Professor Shushi Nair there. He is SARDI's program lead in aquaculture.
80 years of the Country Hour, Australia's longest running radio show.
Hi, I'm Denicia. I'm on a farm at Kalunga, South Australia. Happy 80th birthday to the Country Hour. And I enjoy listening to the Country Hour while travelling in the ute, checking sheep or cleaning troughs.
80 years of the Country Hour.
Finally today, our team of rural reporters have been looking back at some of the biggest stories that they covered in their regions in the year just gone. So let's wrap up with our final region that we need to take a look back at for 2025, and that's the far west of New South Wales, where Christina Rosengren brings us this wrap.
It was a dry start to the year far west of New South Wales in 2025, but there were positive signs for alternative industries in the region, including the government approving developing an air battery. In February, the New South Wales state government approved Australia's first compressed air energy storage system in the far west. Canadian company Hydrostor's billion-dollar project will build a cavern around 600 metres underground next to the old Potosi mine site in Broken Hill. Hydrostor's Martin Becker said the company will compress air and send it down the shaft, where it will stay compressed underground by a 250 megalitre of water reservoir.
This is a 200 megawatt, 1600 megawatt hour or 8 hours of storage. It's a long duration energy storage facility that uses compressed air as its fuel. So the way the facility works is that during high periods of renewable penetration, we use renewable energy to run compressors. Compressors produce compressed air, and that is then stored underground, and the compressed air is our fuel. So compressed air is what is stored underground, and that compressed air is actually kept underground and under pressure by a small reservoir that sits on the surface. So we have been affectionately known as an air battery, if that makes sense. So there's no chemical process here. The air is our fuel. When we are required, the grid needs, the region needs energy, we basically generate. And the way we do that is we use the water to be sent down a shaft into the cavern that sits underground, pushes the compressed air back up to surface, and that runs generators to produce clean energy. So in a nutshell, that's how it works.
Dry times continued through 2025 with low rainfall across regions in outback New South Wales. The dry spell left some sheep and cattle graziers with no choice but to reduce livestock. Rain Western from Marapina Station, 160 kilometres north of Broken Hill, was one of those who made the decision in 2025 to destock completely.
It's not a pretty picture here at Marapina or Selection. There's still some sheep feed on the ground, but it's getting, you know, making the next decisions. We've pretty well destocked. We initially started trying to make that decision a few months ago because we were just being overrun by feral goats and roos were just absolutely flogging us, flogging fences, flogging waters. It is just diabolical. We started looking for adjustment. We weren't able to find any. We sold breeding cows. We've since found some adjustment far and wide, three different directions for the balance of our cattle. These times certainly set you back. We haven't had a general rain as such since the last time. Like, we've still got dams that are dry, but because we haven't had those big rains, the huge creeks one after the other that create the flowing water. And that's what this country's missing, you know, those really big continual rains where you get some decent creeks not far apart each other that run the water to Lake Ban Canyon and all the rest of it.
By mid-year, the rain arrived as Broken Hill recorded its wettest July in 20 years. The town recorded 40.6 millimetres of rain, well above the long-term July average of 17.4 millimetres. And it wasn't just Broken Hill. Decent rain totals were recorded at stations across the far west. For graziers like Richard Wilson, located around 300 kilometres northeast of Broken Hill at Yalda Downs, the rain created a welcome green tinge.
It was a bit varied over our property. Yeah, we had between probably 10 and 18 or 20 initially, which was good. And then it followed up with some more rain. Some places we had another 15 or another 20. So it was a bit varied, but we're starting to see a green tinge on the ground, which is healthy. And haven't been to all the dams yet, but a lot of them only picked up a foot of water. But at least that little bit of extra depth gets the sheep when they're drinking or the cattle away from that boggy area towards the bottom of the dam. So put a smile on everyone's face. We were able to pull up now, but we started selling stock off as a normal practice probably 6-8 months ago. And then we just ramped it up again as dams were getting right down, stock were getting bogged. So the feed's there now. It's not going to be bulky for a long time, but at least it gives everyone an air of optimism again that it has changed.
Following the rain in November, graziers in far west New South Wales called in the King of the Weeds to deal with an outbreak of mesquite. For the past 10 years, Mark Facer and his family have been in New South Wales tackling African boxthorn, mimosa and mesquite. It's a spiny shrub or tree native to the Americas, but here in Australia it's considered one of the worst weeds we can have spreading due to its ability to form dense, impenetrable thickets. He said the infestation in and around Broken Hill was some of the worst he had seen.
Yeah, we travel all over New South Wales and all over Queensland. We've been doing different sorts of weeds control, but yes. So yeah, wherever the weeds are, that's where we go. No, it's real bad, especially in this area. This is the most mesquite I've seen around the country. It's all around here. They've got a bad infestation here. Well, I think it's the only solution for most weeds. We used to spray it, and I got over the spraying because we weren't killing it. We were coming back and doing the bushes again next year or the year after, and next time it'd probably be worse. So I went into brush cutters, and I thought there must be another way to do this. I fiddled around, and because I make my own axes and everything, so I made up a thing to go on the brush cutters so as we could cut and poison at the same time to cut the plant down ground level so as you can still drive over it. You know, if you're driving through the country, that the stumps are not going to, you know, you're not going to have big stumps everywhere. We cut it off ground level and poison it. By doing it like that, the chemical is going straight into the sap flow, straight through to the roots, and the rest of it just fades away after a couple of years, 12 months, 2 years, and it's gone, you know, so. Yeah, but that's it. And we find that this is the only way. Whatever we cut, whatever we poison, is 100% kill.
Broken Hill in the far west have ended the year with some welcome December rain. Graziers are hopeful the showers are a positive omen for more reliable conditions in 2026.
Christina Rosengren there, summarising some of the diverse stories that came from the far west of New South Wales in 2025 and hoping for a really great year for everyone in that region in 2026. That's it for me today. Selena Green with you for the South Australian Country Hour. Have a great rest of your Monday and I will catch you tomorrow for another Country Hour.